Well, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers and everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. And well, before talking about Inhibition, I wanted to advertise a bit the fact that Marie-Julie, my PhD student, is looking for a postdoc. But actually, I just received a mail a few minutes ago telling me that she found a postdoc in MIT. So, wow. So, well, finally, I will advertise our work for her work. And so, for the ones who were at the beginning of the program, I gave a seminar on fracture. And indeed, since I did my PhD, I can't help it, but I'm breaking things all the time. And I have many different types of experiments where, for instance, we are peeling adhesive tapes. And also, more recently, and so again, it's the work of Marie-Julie, we have been interested in looking at the crack interaction in plastic sheets. Here, it's a funny type of material. It's polycarbonate. So it has many funny and interesting properties. First, it has a huge macroscopic zone, a flame shape that you can see here. So the crack is here, and just ahead of the crack, there are a huge plastic zone, macroscopic. And on top of that, it's photoelastic. So you can see how the stress field is modified by the presence of the ABA defect. So here we are fully in pure tensile. And what you can see, I mean, what we have done and what we have been studying, it's how those two cracks are interacting. And interestingly, we observe, depending on this initial distance between the crack, how the crack first repair before attracting each other. And well, it's, if you're interested in that, I can. Anyway, let's jump to the subject of this morning, and of course I will talk about inhibition and specifically avalanches during inhibition. Okay, this belongs to a very general framework about the structure and the dynamic of elastic interface in a random way. And that's the reason why we are here. And of course, I mean, I don't need to, this is a more introductory part, but all of you are really familiar with that. And such a type of dynamic can occur in many different type of system, vortex line, magnetic domain wall, and specifically crack propagation in disordered solids, or contact line. And of course, in the last 20 years and more recently, a lot of work has been devoted to try to capture and understand both the structure first and the dynamic of those objects. But me, I'm an experimentalist, and I would like to insist on two different experiments that I've been working on in the last years, where we are able to capture both, at very microscopic scale, both the structure and the dynamic of those objects. And in particular, what I'm interested in, it's okay, it was just the dynamic of a crack front, and also an elastic line, and the specificity of those two different systems, that the dynamic is non-local. And this is expressed here by, for instance, Garo and Rice. They have been showing that the stress intensity factor along the line depends on the structure of the full structure of the line. And this is the same for in the case of a contact line. And it's this non-local elastic kernel of calculated by Joanne and Deja.
It's also now a case for domain walls where you have non-local elasticity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's specifically, I mean, this type of kernel. Yeah. And that's why I will show you and I will show you example, typical example of the experiment I've been working on and with this typical type. And so the two type of experiments. For the ones again, we are at the beginning of the program or the conference. I have shown you several results concerning this crack front propagating at the interface between two plexiglass plates, and this has been done in collaboration with my Norwegian colleagues, and also more recently my Finnish colleague from Aalto University. But today I will focus essentially on this experiment, which is. A fluid invasion in a fracture media or in a porous media. And this has been done essentially with Jordi Ortin, who is the head of the department, of the physics department in, at the University of Barcelona. And in and we were co-supervising the PhD of Xavier Clotet and with World Common Planets, both in Lyon and in Barcelona. Okay, so first of all, what is imbibition? A bit of etymology, comes from Latin, imbibere. Well, Pierre was proposing to drink a few beers, so so yeah, it means to drinking, of course. And okay, so it's a process of fluid transport in a confined medium, and where you have a fluid that preferentially wets the medium, viscous one, like the oil that we have been using during the experiment, and this place is a resident fluid in this pores or air, for instance. And it can be at constant applied pressure. In that case, we talk about spontaneous imbibition, very right, for instance. Or at constant flow rate. And in that case, it's a forced flow process. And it is forced flow imbibition that I will show you later. And of course, this situation occurs and is relevant for many different applications and oil recovery. If you want to get money in Norway, it's always important to say that you're interested in the physics of oil recovery. Printing processes or biological processes. But also, and this is an everyday experiment that all of you have done, and some of you may have done during the talk. So for instance, when you dip or dunk a biscuit, and actually Len Fisher got the Nobel Prize in 1994 for this experiment. That's a nice image. So what you can see, actually, and this has been done by Hammond, you see that the interface between the wet part, so the coffee is climbing along the stove, the interface is rough. And also, if you have been looking accurately, you could see that the front is advancing by jumps, not smooth. And this is exactly this process that I'm interested in, and paragliding of an interfacial dynamic again in the London medium. This is illustrated by Nicolas Labin in his review, which is already 10 years ago. Okay, so of course the setup is a bit more controlled. So the setup is the following. So we are working with an initial cell, but this cell is disordered. So what do? We have the gap spacing between the two glass plates can take two different values. So it can vary between 0.46 millimeter or 0.4 millimeter. And this is thanks to a random distribution of square obstacles that we deposit at the bottom of the surface of the bottom plate. And the important point, so they have a minimum size of 0.4 by 0.4 millimeter square, and they are covering 35% of this bottom plate. And it's a really mild roughening, so it's just only 13% of this tolerance. And so we are distributing them randomly, as you can see here. And but you can have characteristic size of those objects, which is the characteristic extension, which is about 0.6 millimeter in that case. We measure afterwards. All right, and so what do? With this the simplest model of an open fracture. So we inject, thanks to a syringe pump, we inject silicon powder, and we inject at a constant rate. And what we do is that, thanks to a high-speed camera, we are just looking and observing directly this invasion process. Okay, and even though the flow is globally quite slow, and we are varying the velocity, I will show it after. The point is that in order to capture the local dynamic that can be fast and the local deepening of the front, we are using a high-speed camera. And typically, we are recording 10,000, 20,000, or maybe sometimes more images, and typically 100 seconds. And this is the resolution of the images that we are recording. So, okay, yeah. Here is our two controlling parameters, for instance, the type of the fluid, and we have been changing the viscosity of the silicon oil. between 10 to 350 centiquads. And the important controlling parameter is the velocity at which we are driving our system. And therefore, we have a capillary number which varies between 10 to the minus 4. So this is the important.
What is the capillary number?
So you compare. You compare the viscosity and surface tension. So typically, it's this what tells you. In all of those flow experiments, I mean, this is the important controlling parameter, and this is what I will show you all along my talk. So this is an important parameter. Okay.
What was y? I mean, in this definition.
So sorry.
Y.
No, it's gamma. It's the surface tension of the oil. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the mu viscosity. V is the driving velocity. Okay. So here is a typical experiment that I'm showing.
So again, sorry, is vertical or horizontal?
The cell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's horizontal. Here it's vertical, but it's just to show you. Yeah, it is horizontal. But of course, we could, and we have done also a few experiments introducing gravity, and I will maybe mention that. Okay, so a typical experiment. So this is the raw observation of our experiment. So typically, you can see here the small roughening. Here it's corresponding to those obstacles that we have put at the bottom here. And of course, what you observe, even though we are pushing at a constant impulse flow rate, you see that the front is advancing by somehow some kind of avalanches. And also, what you can see, and I will stop it, it's a bit annoying, but you can see that the interface has a kind of undulation, or there is characteristic wavelength that you could eventually see, and which is much larger than the typical size of the disorder that you introduce in your system. Yes.
What kind of disorder is that actually?
Like I thought I just said that it is exactly this. These are patches obtained by microlithography, so they are square. And the point is that the important point we are modulating the gap spacing. Okay.
Yeah.
And those patches they are randomly distributed, and they. The only thing that we impose, we are covering 35% of the bottom plane. So that you have a random distribution of those patches. And actually, we measure that we have a characteristic size, the extension, which is about 0.6 millimeter. Okay?
How do you decide which ratio between the thickness and the height of the obstacle?
We can choose. Yeah, it's actually, this is a very good point. I wanted my PhD student to vary it systematically. Unfortunately, I didn't have time, but this is an important point. Of course, I mean, this tells you actually the strength of the depinning, if you want, you know, the local capillary force. And of course, I mean, this will be the next step. And for the moment, all the experiments that we have been performing, they have been in these conditions, okay? There have been a few experiments changing that, and I may mention that at the end, and I will show you a few results concerning that part. But of course, I mean, this is important.
So the squares are placed on a grid, basically, at random? The squares are placed on a grid at random?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, it's funny, because this is by a standard lithography technique to obtain electronic balls, you know? But those guys, I mean, when we asked for those, they were, are you sure you want? Because this won't work and you won't get anything with that. But well. Okay, so let's go on. The important thing, okay, as I was mentioning, this is the phenomenology of all of those different systems that we have been discussing here. You have different forces that are acting on the line, on this interface, and they are competing at different length scale. And the important point is that, okay, you have let's say the disorder due to the gap spacing, my patches, they are introducing some fluctuation in the local capillary pressure and as well as the permeability. And this will distort the front. Okay? But those distortions, they are going to be done by two different mechanisms, the viscosity and the surface tension. And on top of that, okay, you have the liquid conservation, you are pushing at constant flow rate. And therefore, all of these mechanisms lead to a non-local kinetic roughening process, and you have both roughness or interfacial fluctuation, and especially you have avalanches. And I will try to focus today on this avalanche dynamic. To go in a bit more detail, and maybe it's one of the most important points to remember of the talk, that those two damping mechanisms. So you have you can express them in a more detailed way. So you have the viscous pressure drop. If you look at, for instance, a typical bump of the interface, and you can express it through the Darcy law, describing the front motion. Okay. And you have the surface tension, and can be expressed through the Laplace law. And what you can observe is that both two mechanisms act at two different scales. And at large scale, the front is damped by viscosity. And at small scale, it's surface tension. And therefore, what is interesting is that you have a characteristic scale, which was two mechanisms crossover. And so this is this characteristic scale along the front. And you can express it as a function of the capillary number that I was telling you at the beginning of the talk. And you have also kappa, which is the permeability of the system. Anyway, we didn't play with that. So the interesting point is that you have a characteristic size in your system, and we can play on it because it depends on mu, the viscosity of the oil, or v, the impulse flow rate. And this size can evolve according to, I mean, those two different controlling parameters that I'm playing with, and varies between 16 millimeter down to 3 millimeter. 16 millimeter is about 15% of the size of my system. And this is much larger than the disorder scale that I'm introducing. Okay?
I'm a little bit confused about where the permeability is coming in at all. What's permeating through what? I mean, so you've got obstacles.
Well, it's the global permeability of my system. You can express it through the Darcy law. Actually, you can measure it, actually, and that's it. And typically, well, okay, you have slight fluctuation, but it's basically the average gap space, b to the square.
But I mean, these would be, so if the bumps were a significant fraction of the width of the channel, then the fluctuations would be huge.
Yeah, sure. But in that case, they are mild, actually, is what I was trying to do.
Okay. I don't overlook, I mean, this interfacial tension, is in this case also the interaction along the interface long range, or?
Actually, it's a bit funny, actually the surface tension in that system, actually within the gap, is what is destabilizing, actually. So you have capillary pressure fluctuation, but for instance, when the front is advancing above the patch, it will be stuck. But here, I mean, also along the line, this is damping, actually. So the surface tension tends to make the interface flat.
My question was, I mean, like this contact line where you, if you integrate out the liquid, then you have essentially long-range elastic forces. Is this here the same, or?
I don't know. It's not clear, and it's a bit an open question, and I would like to, I mean, all what we are showing is that there is some of this long range effect, but okay.
The interfacial tension rule is a local.
Let's go on. So, okay, the analysis procedure. So as you have seen on the movie, it's really easy to directly observe and detect the front. What we have been doing is that we have been extracting the local waiting tank fluctuation during the propagation of the front. And this is something that this is a procedure that we proposed a long time ago, and it was in order to describe the velocity fluctuation of the interfacial crack. And I've seen now that now it's used by a lot of people and so on. So it's nice to see that. So, but basically, I will recall quickly or remind you quickly what we do. And it's very simple. Since again, we can extract all of those fronts, we can simply add them and in a map in order to get the waiting time fluctuation. And it's what I'm showing here. So this is a typical spatial map. Here it's along the front, and here it's in the direction of the propagation. And I obtained that by just superimposing all the different fronts, the 20,000 fronts that I've been recording during the experiment. And what this tells you, it's exactly what you have been observing in the movie. So you have a very fluctuating dynamic, and at many different time and length scale. So here the dark part gives you the zones, the place, the position where the front has been pinned for a very long time, up to more than 1,000. Okay, and the whitish regions correspond to zones where the front went very fast. Basically, it will be like we'll see later on that we call avalanches, or zones where the front went very fast. And you see that typically, both zones can have a typical extension. So the important point, and this is from this type of map, gives you the local waiting time of the front during its propagation. You can invert it simply and get a local velocity field in the mean direction of the front. Okay. And what does that mean? And this is maybe I wanted to be really clear on that. If, for instance, you look just at a given position here along the front, and you look at the height of the interface as a function of time, and what you see is that the front is just advancing always by just one pixel. Okay? And this is how long you have been waiting. And typically what I say is that the local velocity here will be just the average velocity of the front during this time window. So it's a bit peculiar way to define the local velocity. It's the local velocity at the pixel size that I'm choosing. Okay? Of course, we have been varying it. We have been changing it. But the important point is that I'm choosing the acquisition rate of my camera in order that the front is advancing always by only one pixel, not more. I don't have any zeros. So in my mind. So I fully describe and catch the dynamic of the front. And this is an important point. Okay, so what can we do with that? So let's start to, for instance, look at the local velocity of the front along the interface. So this is just at the given time. So again, along the interface, and I'm showing just one typical example. And here what I'm plotting, for instance, you could look at different observable or different things, but here it's the autocorrelation function of this sieve. And what you see is that the local velocity of the front, they are correlating up to very large scales in some times. And here, typically, I'm extracting the blue squares correspond to this characteristic correlation length. And you see that it decays with the imposed velocity. And it is really close, it corresponds to this characteristic length scale that I have been talking to you at the beginning of the talk, this LC, which is given by the capillary number. So again, you have correlation along the front, the local velocity are correlated, and this correlation corresponds to this characteristic length scale, which is given by the viscosity damping, actually, the viscous damping. Let me see, why do you have a big V and a small V? Yeah, I'm sorry. It's what I'm imposing. It's my controlling parameter, the flow rate. And so there comes the interesting point, because we have correlation along the front, and therefore when we look at the fluctuation of, for instance, the average velocity of the front, we expect to have a non-Gaussian fluctuation in peculiar dynamic, because of the presence of those correlation. And the interesting point also is that, and this is what I like in this system, is that we can play on those correlations. We can control and tune them. And therefore, we can perform the so-called finite size effect study. And this is what I'm going to do all along the top. So here, for instance, let's look at the effect of the viscosity, mu, on the local velocity field. And basically, well, I could even stop my talk here, because this is a really beautiful map that Xavier just showing and computed during his PhD. And what you see here is that the viscosity is increasing. So again, it's the local velocity fluctuation, but spatially. It's a spatial map. And what you can see is that when you decrease the viscosity, for instance, you cannot really see here directly, but the interface gets more and more rough. But also, the fluctuations are more and more important. And you can even see that you have the the white, the yellowish and reddish zones are larger, much larger than in this case. And here, what I show you, this scale, corresponds to, again, this, the amplitude of this correlation length along the front, this LC that I... So what you already see is that, more or less, you never have avalanches or huge fast event larger than this scale. And this is important. So, and you see how the viscosity affects, and when you are very high viscosity, the front is more or less flat, the fluctuation are much more than.
What happens if instead of falling, you keep dropping?
Yeah. This is really difficult to play with water, and of course, I mean, we well, we are at 10 centipoise, so okay, we try to go at even lower, but then at some point, I stayed in the regime where the capillary number is maximum 10 to the minus 5. Then the point is that you may start to have overhangs. And therefore, I mean, all of what I'm showing here, it would be a bit more complicated to study that. So you don't have any like fingering and this type of thing. I stay in a regime where you have always a single value interface.
There is this old work by Robin Bruinsma, I think, many years ago,
yes,
where he looks at these different situations. I think,
yep,
he has also this.
Yep.
And indeed finds them fingering and things.
Yeah, you have actually different regimes according to in which, I mean, according to your capillary number. And then, I mean, me, I'm in this capillary regime around 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 5, where I have an interface propagating. I'm staying in this regime. Of course, I would like to reach a regime, for instance, where you have this correlation length diverging and completely reaching the system size. This is what I would like. But it's really experimentally, in this situation, it is difficult to reach. But we have some other way to, and we are working now on this, where you have the interface. We are in a situation where the interface is fully correlated, and we are trying to disturb it and just to see how it. How the interface responds to small fluctuation in the case where you have the interface fully correlated, so fully susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
About the roughness,
or
is the interface flat beyond LC?
No, it's flat beyond LC. It is known to be flat.
Stupid question. Why? So this is only sensitive to the capillary number, right? So
yeah.
Can't you just flow slower?
So
can you just flow slower? Control.
Yeah, sure. But it's the same. Actually, here I'm showing as a function of mu.
Yeah.
But I mean, I played essentially with the first. It was actually Ramon Planet that I was mentioning. His PhD. It played. It systematically changed the velocity. And now Xavier also played with the viscosity. And actually, what you see is the capillary number, which is important. And both. Actually, viscosity and velocity play a different role. But actually, for changing LC, yeah, you can play. But the same, actually, well, what I'm going to show you, when capillary number goes to zero, when the velocity goes to zero, you're reaching the critical point. But actually, really, to reach it, it's experimentally difficult. You have some problems before. And, well, let's go on, because... here it's another way also of looking at the both velocity fluctuation, but in a bit different representation. It's a spatiotemporal map. So here, once again, the grayscale level gives you the local velocity fluctuation, but here it's along the front. We forget that we have a roughness in the y direction, and here it's time, actually. And interestingly, I mean, you see the strong effect of changing the viscosity of the fluid. And basically also what you see is that you have this typical, you really see in which direction the you have the flow, actually, and you have this broken type symmetry and with this typical V shape of those avalanches. And I will discuss that in a bit more detail later on. Okay, from such typical map or the other one, you can extract, for instance, the statistical distribution of the local velocities. So we have been discussing that many times concerning the crack, but here I show you this for the case of post France. And the important thing is that here, so I show you a different type of local velocity distribution. And what you observe here is, for instance, between the red square and the green circles, that they are from very different type of experiment, performed at different velocity and different viscosity. But they are, so the capillary number is exactly the same. And you see that they perfectly collapse. So what is important, the first message is that the capillary number controls the shape of the local velocity distribution. Okay, so here it's written over line by the average velocity, but I'm corresponding to the impulse flow rate. And okay, it's when you increase the capillary number, when you push faster, or when you have a larger viscosity, I mean, it's starting to be more and more squeezed around the impulse velocity. Okay, you could say that you're Paolo, whatever, I mean, it decays extremely fast. So it's not important. You have quite large fluctuations, but in the case where you go very fast, everything is damped. Your interface is flat, and you don't see large avalanches, the correlation rank is really small. But when it decreases, you start to have wider and wider distribution, a very large fluctuation. In particular, also, it starts to develop like this, this maybe eventually a pole or whatever, I mean, it's not important, but it is around the average velocity, so it's starting to develop. And this is interesting. Well, I mean, well, here it's a very small one. And I want to comment this because, well, I will go on later on, but well, it's close to 2, I think. Yeah, I mean, but I don't know if it's a power law or not. But the interesting point is that I did some preliminary experiments a long time ago when I was in Oslo, and where for a real porous medium, imagine a glass big packing, actually, in a show cell. In exactly the same configuration, and in that case I had very large velocity, local velocity distribution, really close to the what I could see in the case of fracture. And this has strong consequences on the global dynamic and the global velocity fluctuation. And also I want to point out that it looks very different compared to the distribution that you were showing several years the other day. And well, so this is something that I want to pursue and to go on and changing systematically the disorder of my cells, for instance, going and increasing the size of the obstacle up to reach completely the gap, and you have almost a real porous medium in that case. And yeah.
Excuse me, the smallest velocity you show.
Yep.
Ground yeah, sure. Where the ground is discretization. What do you mean, sir?
Well, this, all of this is measured at the pixel size. Okay? It's the local velocity at the pixel size. But I changed the resolution and I didn't see. Yeah, it's really small. It's smaller than the size of the disorder that I'm introducing, of course. I'm resolving the size of the patches, of course. But I didn't see any effect on the resolution of those distribution. Okay, so drawn. So again, I show you. I've been showing that many times. This local velocity field. So from that, we can define avalanches. And maybe I will spend a few minutes. Just it's a different way than usually people define avalanches. And so what you can do, for instance, so here again, the grayscale level gives you the waiting time or the local velocity. You can threshold this map. So for instance here, I show you those whitish regions correspond to zones where the front has been C time, in that case 1.5 times faster than the imposed average velocity. This is what I call avalanche. Of course, I mean, you can change the threshold, and of course it will change the average size of those clusters. But from that, so you can define local bursts or local avalanches, okay? And since we know also that we have we have recording the fronts during the propagation, we can from the position of the front and at which end they were entering a cluster and leaving a cluster, you can define the duration of those objects. Okay? And this is given by the call code here. So we are going to the corresponding
So how does this cutoff compare to the distribution, the velocity distributions you were showing us on the previous slide?
What do you mean by how does
So there was a power law and then it was
yes.
something. So
yeah. Basically, I mean, it corresponds, you cut, you're looking at fast velocities. I'm looking just, I'm binarizing and I'm looking at just fast velocities, okay? And you can do it in different ways. Well, it's a bit technical, but what do you want to know?
No, I mean, if you put the threshold all the way down, where, so for instance, if I look at the blue guy at the lowest capillary number,
yeah.
I see some feature at 10 to the 1, end of the 1.
Yeah.
If you put the cutoff below, do your avalanches disappear and everything percolates, or?
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, you have to choose a given range of your of your value for the threshold. Yeah. And if you go too low, I mean, you will get everything, or if you go too high, you don't have anything.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but I can check on the papers. I don't remember exactly in which range we have checked, but it's what I'm going to show you just after. I mean, what we have, the first important thing is when you do that, you have to check how the, your procedure change or affects the observable that you're looking at. For instance, the size distribution of your avalanche. And, so. And what we have shown is that in the reasonable range, you have always a power law and the cutoff, and it is the cutoff, the exponential cutoff, that is affected by the clipping procedure. Okay? I will just show you quickly.
So the average V means the velocity of the.
Yep. Okay, so first of all, we can look, for instance, at the structure of those avalanches, and looking at the shape, you get it, so they have you extract the smallest bonding box enclosing those objects, and you look at the typical spatial extension in the direction of propagation and the lateral extension. And what you observe is that they have a typical anisotropic shape with a given exponent, which is close to 0.8. Okay? And, well, of course, here it's for many different velocities for a given clipping value, but I should have shown it. For a given velocity and different clipping value, you don't see any variation, okay?
And here,
propagation
is in the Y?
Propagation is wide, yeah.
Okay.
All right?
Yep.
So they are more elongated along the front,
mm.
okay?
Mm.
And you have this typical 0.8 exponent.
Visualize
the
velocity?
Yes. So both are the avalanches, both isolated clusters. So again, this is what I'm calling avalanches. So all of those points inside this avalanche, inside this cluster, have a velocity which is larger than the average velocity, and of a given amount, in that case, 1.5 larger than the mean velocity. And this is surrounded by velocities that are smaller. Okay?
Yeah,
it's what I'm showing before. It's the raw data that I have here. It's what I have. Here, I mean, the gray level, each value of the gray level gives you the local velocity. But how do you define an avalanche? Me, I chose this procedure.
You should isolate, which is very good. You can shoot for the full picture.
Again, I'm not sure what you... For the full picture, what do you mean by...
Next slide, you should
isolate. You mean here?
Mm-hmm. Just
feeling. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Well, this
is. I
don't understand what your question is here. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Here, what I'm showing is typically Ly for each avalanche.
I understand. What are isolates or what?
Well, okay. So then, I mean, this is a 2D distribution. Okay, here, for instance, what I'm showing is just the average. At a given Ly.
This is isolated of what quantity?
Okay, the amplitude, I mean, it's a 2D histogram. So you can count here how many objects that have this given value for Ly and this given value for Lx. Okay? Well, it's a way of representing. Let's go on. So, it's almost nothing. so here you have avalanches. So I'm showing the distribution of the size, the area of the avalanches. And here it's for different velocity for giving different value. And here it's for impulse, the given value of the velocity, given experiment, where I change the clip. And you see that you have a power law, and it's just the cutoff that is evolving as a function of the clipping. Okay? And the important thing is that, and it's just what I want to say here, is that, okay, you have a cutoff, an exponential cutoff, which is diverging when you go, in that case, when you are pushing slowly and slowly, when the capillary number goes to zero. And, okay, so that's what I wanted to say here. And for instance, okay, if you want to extract the typical value of the exponent, it's close to one. And that's it, so it's really robust. And here I'm showing it only for the experiments at different velocity, but we have much more data as a function of viscosity and so on. So, and okay, so we have a power loss scaling with an exponent which is close to one, in the case of the size of slow slow
cutoff. And what's the exponent for how the cutoff changed? I missed that.
The variation of the cutoff?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to...
Okay.
I don't know if I'm showing it. No, I'm not, but I'm showing it here, but I'm just... Okay. I will comment on it.
Okay.
So you can do the same for the duration of those avalanches. Again, they are power distributed, and what is evolving as a function of the controlling parameter is the cutoff. And the cutoff diverges when the capillary number is getting smaller and smaller. Okay? And again, the power law is close to one, the power exponent. So here it's a kind of summary. And the important thing, to correspond to your question, Carol. Okay, if you look at, for instance, the distribution of the lateral extent of the avalanches, there are, again, so this power law, but it's really on a short, it's not a very wide range, close to the decay. But anyway, the cutoff evolves in the same way as this characteristic length scale that I was introducing at the beginning of my talk. So the important thing is that what is controlling the spatial expansion or the maximum spatial expansion of my avalanches, this is this characteristic length scale that I was discussing at the beginning. So, and from that, from this behavior, we can infer the behavior of the cutoff for the size and for the duration of the local clusters. Okay, so it's what I'm showing in the set. Okay, and well, maybe the important comment is that okay, all of this behavior it's not a trivial consequence of the statistical properties of my disorder. My avalanches are much much bigger than the size of the disorder that I introduced. And again, what is controlling the size of those avalanches is the lateral correlation length, LC.
And do you know what is controlling the shape, in the sense that it's...
No. Well, yeah, we can discuss that, but it's mm-hmm. not. Of course, you have the shape that enters to play, to understand the scaling of the cutoff for the area or the mm-hmm. duration. Well, you have many different types of scaling behavior for those global avalanches. And here I'm showing, for instance, the lateral extent of the avalanches as a function of their duration, or their typical size or area as a function of the duration. And you can extract different type of scaling exponents. Yes, the interesting point is that, for instance, and it's really close to what the one that you are showing yesterday. So that's why I wanted to insist on that. Even though I didn't want to discuss that, but well. Okay, for instance, you have this dynamic exponent, which is close to one. And the way I see it is like it reflects if you look at the spatial-temporal map that you observe, you have a kind of ballistic lateral propagation of my avalanches. This is this shape that we can observe. And the interesting point is that this is really different up to now in comparison with what people in the literature have been published. On numerical or theoretical prediction of such a system, actually. So, typically those results are obtained from this type of approach, and describing the dynamic of the front in this field. This has been detailed in all of these papers and in the original thing.
What is the reason for having a Q
It's not clear to me, and honestly, yeah, it's. So I will send you back to this weekly. And of course, what you have here is that you have a Q and a Q cube, and this is telling you just what I was saying at the beginning, the fact that those two damping mechanisms, this is the viscous drop. And this is the surface tension effect. And they are playing at different scales.
But normally you would get a Q squared, right?
No, in that case you don't actually, and this is an important point. But I won't be able to tell you this. Yes. But
you have an explanation for that?
No, I just look at this with you, but I cannot tell you.
But the point is that all up to now, all the results reported in the literature, I mean, qualitatively we obtain the same. But if you look at quantitatively at this local scale, all the exponents are very different from the predictions that are given here. And well, interestingly, FNAV, it's really close to what we were. Yeah, but it shouldn't be one square. I mean, that's the point. So that's why I decided to show all of this, because just to trigger a discussion with you. But it shouldn't be KPZ. But I mean, if you look at those values, they are really close. Well, actually, we discussed that in this paper, because this has been published quite some time ago.
Sorry?
Yeah.
And 1.3 and 2 for the exponents based on the same equation?
Well, just the same quantity they were observing. For instance, if you look at the spatiotemporal map that they extract here in the case of the simulation of Marc Pradas, actually you see that the shape of those avalanches here, they are really different to comparing to what we are observing in our case.
And I mean the dynamic exponent should be...
It's different, it's what I'm saying. The dynamic exponent that they form, that they get, is really different compared to what the one that I'm extracting.
Does it simulate this equation? Or
yes, it? Yes. It's phase field simulations.
Okay, so why is it 1.3 and 2? What's different?
I don't know. That's the point. Also in the literature, simulation of the same type of... and the same type of simulation, both are phase field, they don't give the same exponent. So, and this is an open question, because this is these are our colleagues. Nico Alada is the co-author of this paper. I asked him many times, but now we are restarting to redo numerical simulation like this, and to check quantitatively what's the difference with what we're observing. But well, okay, actually. What I wanted to insist on and what I would have liked to show you is more all the statistical properties of what I call global velocity. Because this is the interesting point of this system, that we're able to have, we have access to microscopic quantities. And from these microscopic quantities, the local velocity of the interface, we can build an average velocity, the average velocity of the front. And this is, and you can average it at different scale. And again, what will be important finally is the scale at which you compute this average velocity. You have to compare it to the scale at which you have those correlations along the front. And this is what really controls the dynamic. And the point is that again, we can do this type of finite size study, and looking at the different statistical properties of those. Of this typical crackling noise signal, depending at which scale you are computing the average velocity, in comparison with this characteristic length scale at C as well. And what I want to insist also on that, so here for instance, if you look at this typical burst of global velocity, which corresponds to the main global advancement of the front, this is average velocity in time, okay? If you look at between those two different times, you have the front, and here is the spatial map that I was showing you before. So you see that this global avalanche corresponds to many different local clusters that can occur at different locations along the interface. And some of those avalanches may be correlated, some not. But all of those clusters, they give rise to this global burst. Okay? And this is this has strong consequences.
You cut off all this.
What was that?
You cut off all these little wiggles under the 0.2.
0.2 what?
There is a curve hidden behind. Apparently.
There is a curve. Here. Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm pushing at the constant flow rate. This is the average velocity of the front. Okay. You can decide also to cut at different values. Sure. But here, I mean, I'm showing it just, I mean, it's the, what is above the average velocity, all right? And so it's a way of defining a global avalanche. And then I'm looking at, so this typically, this is a typical avalanche. And here it starts at this time and it finishes at this time. And you can see, you can observe that it corresponds to many different local clusters of very high velocities along the interface during this window.
So what is LC on this picture?
Yeah.
LC is typically, I mean, yeah, I should have shown it, unfortunately. It's typically, I mean, this, you see those V-shaped bursts, I mean. Here. Well, typically it will be a bit less than 10 millimeters. So LC, again, fixes the maximum extent, the spatial extent.
So there should be an oscillation beyond LC?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's what I've said until now. Okay, I'm sorry, but I will have to go very fast. So, okay, we can look at the statistical distribution of the global velocity. The important, for instance, you look at the amplitude, just the, so you have this global velocity measured at a given scale, and you look at how it fluctuates in time. And I'm looking at this quantity. So here I'm showing different global velocity distribution. The important point is that for all the various experiments that I've been performing, you can collapse those distributions as soon as the velocity, this average velocity, is computed at a scale such that L over LC is fixed. So here it's, for instance, 10, 2, 1, and then 0. So actually, when you're computing this velocity at the scale which is much larger than the correlation length, actually you get distributions that are really close to a Gaussian statistic. But you see, when you are measuring this velocity closer and closer to this characteristic correlation length, you start to develop a non-Gaussian statistic with this exponential thing. And I will go quickly, but this can be well described by a generalized Gumball type of distribution. These are not fixed. I just put the expression of a generalized number, which depends actually on only one single parameter, it's the skewness of this distribution, and I put it back and I just plot it on top of it. So, and the point is that a lot of theoretical work, even some experiments, have shown and proposed that in a...
So can you recall the
phase of the... It's an exponential thing here.
And on the other side?
Here, on the, this side, this, voila. I will show you the expression of the generalized Gumball, but this is not that important. Well, the important thing is that the skewness is the controlling parameter of this, and it relates, actually, and what is interesting, here you have fluctuation of the amplitude of this global signal. And the point is that it's directly linked to this ratio L over LC. What is L over LC? It's just the number of independent domains that you have along the front. And what you get is that when you're approaching the value 1, meaning that you're close to the correlation, of course, you are summing or you're averaging over correlated quantities. And therefore, it's not surprising that you get a non-Gaussian signal. And in that case, you get a Gumball or generalized Gumball. And so the point is that I wanted to make a small digression on what I've shown a few weeks ago in the case of fracture. This is very different because the local velocity distribution in the case of fracture, they are power law, okay? They are not like, and the power law is more fat actually, it's smaller exponent. So that all the moments of the second order and third order are not well defined. And in that case, you can average at whatever length scale, you will never reach a Gaussian statistic. And in that case, you converge towards how do you say, early leaf light.
So what's the exponent?
What is the exponent? It's m?
It's 1.0 plus 1. So
yeah, just to tell you that m, actually, when you are upscaling, when you are averaging the global, you're looking at the global velocity fluctuation, what is concerned, it's this value, m. Here it is. Here is the global velocity distribution, so the average velocity, this average local velocity, and you converge toward this Levy flight. And the tail here, it's a Paolo tail, and it's given like m. Okay? So you can predict that, you're just invoking the general generalization of the central limit theorem. So in a way, I've shown you but two typical examples where you can get a non-Gaussian statistic. Yes?
Not one.
Yeah?
Sure. It's minus and minus 1, right?
Yes, sorry. It's minus and
minus 1.
Yeah, it was minus. Okay, but well, and again, I was showing you a few weeks ago that we can also look at the shape of this object. How long time? Can I continue for
10 minutes?
10 minutes? Okay, well, great, it's okay. Some people maybe not. But well, okay, so we can look at the. So this is again the global velocity signal, okay? And as a function of time. And you can look at not only at the size of a subject, the duration of a subject, but you can look also at the full excursion. So what people have been computing in the last years now, the so-called average average shape. And this is what I'm showing here to you, this average shape. And here, I mean, I'm showing you also the scaling of the size of the avalanches as a function of their duration. Okay, and you have this scaling low with this exponent 1.7. Okay, and the point is that we proposed recently, and now Pierre and Kai, they have some prediction for the average shape of a subject, and we have shown that it can be well described by such scaling. And with only one given exponent, gamma, which is this exponent, relating again the size versus the duration. And here, for instance, I can fit this expression to extract the gamma exponent, and we obtain something like gamma close to 1.074. Okay, the interesting point is that it's my Finnish colleague. They have played with different type of elastic line model, changing systematically the kernel, okay, and the value alpha. And what they have been observing is that it modifies systematically the shape of the average avalanche, okay. And what you can see is that you can really distinguish our case from the two limit cases, for example, the Poincaré Wilkinson case. Or the full nominal case.
Can I ask
alpha equals 0. Yes?
If you talk about interfacial factor, you mean you glue two pieces together?
Yeah, this was the, I'm sorry, it's, I went a bit too fast on that. So the experiment was the following. So you take two plexiglass plates. You introduce some roughness, some disorder by sandblasting them. So you get a rough interface, surface. Then you clamp your two plates together, you put that in an oven. So you're sintering them.
Yeah.
So you have this annealing procedure, so that you're recreating a block, but with some connection. But of course, I mean, along this interface, which is weak, you will have a fluctuation of the local toughness, the threshold for rupture. And then what you do, of course, when you, afterwards, you try to open this block, exactly in this way, of course, the crack will propagate along the interface. So this is a very elegant procedure to impose the crack form to propagate along this interface. But of course, since you have disorder, again, fluctuation in the local rupture threshold, the interface will have some roughness and will advance by avalanches. So all of what I've been doing, actually, I was working essentially in this on this problem, and then I jumped on the inhibition problem, because in that case we can control the disorder. The problem in this experiment, the disorder is not there well controlled. But okay, and all the phenomenology is the same, but of course, I mean, the physics is very different. And I will just make a smaller aparte because I was discussing that a lot with colleagues and so on. So this is the experiment, okay?
So here you're now in a real critical regime where you're pulling slowly and you expect finite side effects, whereas with the inhibition.
The point, I mean, here, I mean, in the case of fracture, I never see any finite size. I mean, it's you have a correlation. Yeah. Actually, you have some correlation. Yeah. I mean, due to the disorder that you introduce.
Yeah.
But I can average. I mean, if I look at the statistical properties of the global velocity,
yeah,
at whatever scale above the correlation length,
mm-hmm,
I do not see any variations. Mm-hmm. It's always this Levy flight.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is that the local velocity distribution have this fat tail, mm-hmm, with this specific exponent that I was showing you before. And this is really different than in the case of inhibition.
Mm-hmm.
In inhibition, actually, you have a really fast decay.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, and this is the point, when I'm going, I should try to go even slower, then the local velocity fluctuation might change at this four tail, and then the global velocity will be affected. Mm-hmm. But I haven't reached this region yet.
Can you just repeat one more time what the red was, QEW? What is that?
So it's simulation performed by Lasser and Xavier, and they have changed systematically, I mean, in their simulation, in this elastic line model, the non-local kernel, actually.
No, and then I understood, but...
So they choose, so systematically they change elasticity. Alpha, they go...
No.
And the elasticity is French.
Yeah. And
oh.
French difference.
Yeah, it's and they go from alpha equals zero to, I mean, you change systematically this value, and what you observe is that it affects typically the
yeah,
shape, systematically the shape of your average.
No, that I understood. I was just wondering, the red curve, you're saying that's
French,
when you're saying?
That's very common.
Oh, okay. Mm. So near.
Thank you, okay.
Okay, great.
The point, what is also interesting, is that based on our measurement, what we expect to have alpha equal 2, and therefore gamma equal around 1.8. And it is, I mean, basically what I've been measuring. So basically, you could also measure this average shape of the avalanches and infer the type of kernel that describing the elastic interaction. So this was the one point of this paper. Okay, but well, let's go back now. Inhibition. You can do exactly the same, and again, looking computing all your different avalanches. And this is what I'm showing here, the average avalanche shape. And what is peculiar here is that those avalanches are tilted, they are asymmetric. Okay? And the asymmetry depends on the scale at which you are computing your average velocity. And it depends systematically on this quantity that I've been calling L over C. This number of independent domains along the front.
But this is not the global average, this is the average in an individual avalanche that you're...
It's just the global velocity.
Yeah.
The you have your the average velocity of the front, you can measure it, you can average it at different scales,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you can choose whatever the scale.
Yeah.
But what is important is that you have to keep in mind that, again, you have correlation along the front.
Uh-huh.
And what is important, all the statistical properties of this quantity depends on how far you are from LC. And the average shape depends systematically on this ratio L over LC. So you can, this corresponds to many different type of experiment performed in many different conditions, different velocities, different viscosity, but all of the avalanches collapse as soon as the average velocity is computed such that L over LC is fixed. Okay. And what we show here is that when you're approaching this characteristic correlation length, you get more and more distorted. Okay, it's more and more symmetric. Or you can go in the other way. You're about to be symmetric when you are at 20 times LC. And on top of that, the value of gamma is changing, is evolving. Okay. Well, so always, yes.
Well, what depends on how you
define
it.
So you have a strong acceleration here, mm-hmm. and then the deceleration is strong.
So there could be maybe a near dilation effect with the dust, you know, or so.
It's what I'm trying to infer now these days, and I will show you one thing if I have time. I will just go quickly, just by saying that, okay, I will not describe it, but what is funny is that we have shown very recently that all of this dynamic, even though it's slow, it is you have some spatiotemporal intermittency. And we have been able to pinpoint what are the characteristic scales that are controlling this intermittent behavior. Okay? And intermittency in the sense of people who have studied turbulence for many years. I just did that because in my lab, I've seen those type of plots and the type of analysis all my life almost. So typically, this is, okay, just two words. This is typical multiscaling analysis, and just to infer if you have complex temporal correlation. What you look at, so again, the global velocity signal, you can look at what we call velocity increments. And you can, so it's the difference between the global velocity at t plus tau minus the one at t. And you can do it for different tau, time delay, and you can also do it for different scales at which you're computing global velocity. So here I show you for one given experiment at a given impulse velocity, given viscosity, and a given scale at which we have been computing it. And what you see is that the distribution of those velocity increments, they evolve through the temporal scales, from very fat tail to Gaussian. And this is what people in turbulence call intermittency. And on top of that, what is a bit interesting and what is really interesting to me is that also those distributions are a bit tilted. You have a positive asymmetry again. And so this could have a strong signification. And in the case of turbulence, it has. It is related directly to the cascade of energy through the scale. But I don't have time to go there. What I want just to say is that, okay, depending on the scale at which we're computing the velocity, or the viscosity and the velocity at which we drive our system, all of those distributions evolve systematically. And we have been able to detect the two characteristic scales that are controlling this intermittent behavior. So one is the temporal scale, which tells you the temporal range over which you have this intermittent behavior, and it is directly related to the disorder that we have introduced in our system. But on top of that, again, what controls the intensity of the intermittent behavior, how fast they are and how they evolve slowly or fast through the scale, this is controlled by NC.
What happens if you change
energy? I want to do that. the student didn't have time, but it is all what I've shown you. I mean, it calls for that. I mean, it's the conclusion of the physics. Come on, it was in the introduction. It was the subject that I proposed to him. He has done a lot, but he didn't reach the point to change the typical size of the disorder. But this is what this experiment is calling for. And it's hopefully what I'm going to do now.
You have an asymmetry?
I have an asymmetry, yes. You look at it. Here, for instance, you look at this six times the standard deviation. Here. So you have a positive asymmetry. And this is what I want also to check out these days. But, well, I will conclude here. So I hope I've shown you what is force flow inhibition, where you have a viscous wetting fluid which is forced to invade a confined disorder medium. And here it's at a constant flow rate, that's why I call it force flow. And I hope I convince you that we have a model experimental setup that allows us to really have a control of especially the heterogeneities of the system, and this is what we want to do next. And also I've shown you our detailed statistical analysis that has allowed us to infer and to characterize all the statistical properties that are quite peculiar of the dynamic of this interface. And the important point is that, well, maybe the conclusion, I wanted to show you that, I've just shown you that, but we have been able to show that we have an intermittent dynamic. And this intermittency is really like, I will dare to say that. And that's for my colleagues in children. But somehow we can have, I would say, an interscascade of avalanches. And why I'm saying that? Well, first, because what we have shown is that this global intermittency, the intermittency of this global behavior, is related directly to the fact that we have clusters of local, very fast events, those correlated motions. And those correlated motions, what I call avalanches, they are parallel distributed from the smallest scale of the disorder that I introduced up to the larger scale of the spatial extent is cut by the viscous cutoff, actually. So it's from small scale up to large scale. And this is in that sense that I want to say that I may have a kind of inverse cascade. And this could be related to this positive asymmetry that I observe. But it's a bit...
So you're injecting energy at large scale?
No, I'm injecting energy at large scale, of course. But what is important is that it depends. You have the scale of the system, but what everything is triggered at the scale of the disorder. And of course, you have very tiny avalanches, but you have correlation at much larger scale. Actually, the avalanches that we have observed, they can be much larger. And this is in that sense. What I think is important is, again, the scale of the disorder that I introduced, and the larger scale of the avalanches, which is the correlation along the interface. And yes, that's the point. It's a bit speculative, but I dare. And to mention a few things and in order to, the perspective and the ongoing work. Of course, what we have been playing with highly disordered method, but now we are going back to the simpler scale of a single obstacle. And what you observe, if you look at the average velocity, at different scales, close to the scale of the patch, and this is the average velocity in time, and you see that how the velocity behaves when you enter in the obstacle, it's already highly asymmetric. So you have a strong acceleration as soon as you're touching your patch, and then you have this deceleration. And what I think is that this is what is at the origin of the asymmetric shape of my avalanches. And I will stop there because it's a bit too much and you might be tired.
Any other questions?
What about looking at the
meniscus? If you you have only great question and open question, and this is ongoing and perspective, direct observation of the interface within the gap. This is exactly what we have to do because we can have access to the local force on the interface. And especially when you were saying that yesterday, the patch is the obstacle that I have introduced. Because of the procedure and the way we are preparing them by microlithography, they are very steep, you know? And this, for sure, have a strong influence on this on the contact line, probably. And that might affect a lot the dynamic. So I would like now, the procedure is that, well, of course, it's I have some other ways to prepare a disordered plate. And with the more smooth obstacles, and this will be also the next step. So all what we have shown here is calling to play with the disorder, and this is also the great point of this experiment, is the fact that we can do it and we can control it. We know perfectly the disorder that we have introduced in our system. Now it's time to play with it.
Okay, we can thank the speaker.
Merci.